Broadcasting live from Wilmington, North Carolina, it's time for Cape Fear Seniors, where those who impact seniors' lives gather to tell their stories.
Welcome to Cape Fear Seniors. I'm Tom Petcher, your host, and today we're speaking to Kelly Shevelin, the founding attorney of the Four Pillars Law Firm here in Wilmington. Kelly, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Tom.
Most law firms are named after the attorney or attorneys involved. Smith, Jones, and Perkins.
Sure.
In coming up with a name for your office, you went in a different direction. Why Four Pillars? What's the significance of that moniker?
Basically, when I established my practice, I wanted to focus on four basic areas of the law that I thought are really important for pretty much everyone. That's estate planning and administration, asset protection. There's a veterans benefit called improved pension aid and attendance benefit that we focus on planning for, as well as long-term care planning. And so basically, since we have those four core practice areas, I decided to name my law firm Four Pillars Law Firm.
Good thinking. So they really are the four pillars both of your practice, but also in a lot of ways the four pillars of needs of people, especially as they age.
Exactly. I mean, basically, everyone should have an estate plan in place as well as a long-term care plan in place. So that's what we look to, work with our clients and achieve their end goals, basically not only to take care of preserving their wealth, but also to take care of them during their lifetimes and making sure that they're properly cared for and their needs are cared for. And then what's left to the next generation is wonderful. But of course, our focus is on taking care of our clients themselves.
Right. At what point in your time in law school did you begin to decide on elder law and estate planning? And really, what contributed to that decision? There are a lot of different law you could have practiced as you were getting your degree. What led you to this area and why?
Sure. I entered law school knowing that I wanted to move in a transactional direction. I didn't want to be in front of the judges in the courtroom. Mm-hmm. That just wasn't my interest. I'm much more about taking care of clients, bringing them together, and making sure that they're properly cared for during their lifetime. So when I was in law school, I basically looked back on, my family and what I wanted to achieve for other people. And my family's been touched by all levels of estate planning and long-term care planning. My family's has always been very thoughtful and proactive in planning for their future, both for retirement but as well as their care needs. I had one grandmother who basically had physical issues all of her life, at the end of her life, but she was able to stay in the home. That's because my mother actually decided to move in with her. She still worked for full-time, but was basically a caregiver when she came home for my grandmother.
Mm-hmm.
My other grandmother actually suffered from Alzheimer's, and so with her, she ended up the last few years of her life in a long-term care facility. She was on Medicaid. So, they both had very different experiences with their end of life. My parents currently, they just retired. They are enjoying life. They play golf. They have the time of their life. They travel all the time. But at the same point, they're paying for a placement in a continuing care retirement
mm-hmm.
community.
Mm-hmm.
So they're looking down the line to what their needs may be in the future. And so in looking, at my family and what they've gone through, that's pretty much where, I tended to look toward helping people, with my practice.
So you had the luxury of seeing best practices in action with your family, especially with your folks and your one grandmother.
Exactly.
Good.
Exactly.
Great, great. Let's dig deeper into the concept of estate planning. What it is, why it's important. Is it simple or can it get more complex?
Estate planning, there are some core documents that I recommend that everyone have in place. That includes a general durable power of attorney. That's basically allowing you to appoint someone as your agent to make your legal and your financial decisions should you not be able to do so.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a healthcare power of attorney. Same concept, but it's for your healthcare decisions. Some people may have one child that they think would make better healthcare decisions for them, while another child would be better with legal and financial decisions.
And healthcare power of attorney kicks in to use when the individual really can't make those decisions for himself or herself.
Exactly. Basically, you're making the decision.
Which we're all at the risk of happening to us.
Of obviously. Course.
Right.
I mean, whether it's a car wreck when you're young, mm-hmm. a stroke when you're older, everyone, may come to a point where they're not able to make decisions for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So essentially, with these documents, you're empowering yourself to make those decisions for yourself while you're able to, instead of leaving it to the courts and the state to make those decisions for you. Beyond those two core documents, there's also, I think, heavily a need during your lifetime for a living will, where you basically make your end-of-life decisions for yourself. And there's a HIPAA release authorization that allows agents that you appoint access to your medical records, because mm-hmm. if you don't provide that authorization, then no one has access to your medical records under the law. So those are four core documents I think everyone needs to have in place. Essentially, that takes care of you during your lifetime. Beyond that, everyone thinks about a will, but mm-hmm. there are so many other ways that you can leave assets to, you know, your spouse and your children. A will is certainly appropriate for some people, but, you know, a trust may be another thing that you may want to consider.
And that's where things get a little bit more complicated in terms of planning. Is that correct?
A little more complicated in terms of planning, but really it won't affect it. You know, if you're doing a living trust to transfer assets upon your passing, it is more robust and can provide a lot of additional advanced planning opportunities
right.
that you really don't have under a standard will.
Before we get more deeply into trust, because I want to talk about the concept at least at a high level so people understand why trusts are important and why they may be applicable to a particular individual, I want to go shoot back for a quick visit to the living will. Mm-hmm. The living will, as I think we understand it, is where you, when you are of sound mind and body, make the determination about whether you want extraordinary measures taken, should you have a significant health event, to what level you want them taken, whether you have what's called a DNR, do not resuscitate. Is there anything else involved in the living will besides those two issues?
The living will essentially allows you to state, you know, do you want life prolonging measures mm-hmm. if you are at the end of your life? You know, the healthcare power of attorney, you appoint your agent to make healthcare decisions for you. By executing a living will, you're essentially telling your agent what you would want to have happen, you know, because you're not going to be able to communicate with them at that time. So you're leaving them with a heavy burden of, you know, deciding, you know, what treatments mm-hmm. you should receive or not receive when you're not able to communicate what you would otherwise want to have happen. So the living will essentially is your directive to your agent, letting them know, do you want life prolonging measures? You know, do you want artificial nutrition and hydration mm-hmm. maintained, you know, at the end of your life, or would you like those things removed?
Otherwise known as advanced directives, correct?
Exactly,
yes, right.
Yeah.
So let's hop back over to trusts. Well, not so obvious, but I think I'm correct in assuming that a trust really does need to be drawn up by an attorney, because the language has to be accurate, has to be exact to the law. Talk about the kinds of trusts that are out there that might be germane to, you know, an individual who is looking at retirement, has basically either modest or, you know, everyday assets, not a whole lot of money. Are trusts necessary or important for Joe Blow?
I mean, a lot of people think, I don't need a will, I don't need a trust, because, you know, I mean, the estate tax exemption at this point is over $5 million.
Right.
So basically, you can pass over $5 million to whoever you want and not have any estate taxes. So that's what most people, you know, consider trusts in the past. Essentially, at this point, I think trusts are there for a completely different reason, and not all trusts are created equal. A revocable living trust that I often use for people who are healthy and basically are looking to transfer assets upon their passing, my revocable living trust, it talks about, you know, the assets are there for you during your lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't use them for whatever you want. But if you are to become disabled, then someone else is going to step in as trustee of your trust in order to manage that money. But again, you know, the money is there for you for your benefit during your lifetime. The trustee is supposed to use it for that purpose.
Right.
When you pass, a lot of trusts that I've seen just basically leave assets outright to your beneficiaries. But there are so many other options and opportunities as to how you can leave those assets. I often talk to clients about, instead of leaving the money outright to their children,
mm-hmm.
Leave it in a creditor-protected trust. The money's still there for the benefit of your child completely, and they can even be trustee of their trust. But, you know, essentially, if you leave it in a creditor-protected manner, then if your child is in an accident and found liable or makes bad business decisions,
I see.
Anything like that, the money that you leave behind to them is there protected, so that even though they may lose their life savings and what they've earned during their lifetime, their inheritance is protected, and so there's still a nest egg for them regardless.
And that's a legal move.
Absolutely. absolutely legal planning technique that I think is very beneficial.
Why wouldn't anybody do that?
I have a hard time with that answer.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, some people have had bad experiences with trusts. I think that's more perhaps a bad experience with the firm that they chose and the planning methods that were done. I am a firm believer in leaving inheritances creditor protected to the children. Again, it's a safety nest egg so that they always have something there for their benefit. And it's not just for lawsuits and judgments. I mean, also think about, you know, one in two marriages ends in divorce.
Right.
I mean, that's a fairly well-known statistic. Well, if you leave the money creditor protected to your child and they leave it in that trust, even if they go through a divorce, that money's off the table.
Because the divorced spouse, it actually becomes
a creditor.
Yeah,
a creditor.
Right, right.
So even though they may have to divide up the assets that they've earned during their marriage, that creditor protected trust inheritance is off the table. The soon-to-be ex-spouse has no right to any of that money. So, you know, basically you can ensure that the inheritance is left for your child and their children and not to a soon-to-be ex-spouse.
You can see where it's called a creditor protected trust. You can see where that would become increasingly important as the value of the inheritance increases as well.
Exactly. Most certainly. And then, you know, beyond that, another reason to use a creditor protected trust is if you have a child with special needs,
mm-hmm.
Especially if they're receiving government benefits, some of them may be financially based. So if they're if they receive an outright inheritance from you, then they may lose some of the benefits
right.
until all that money's spent down. And then, you know, at that point, then they'll go back on benefits. Whereas if you leave it in trust to them, that's properly worded. I mean, you know, it has to be appropriately worded. But then that money is protected there for them to supplement their quality of life beyond what the benefits that they receive cover. So there are, you know, a number of different planning options that you can utilize in going forward with a revocable living trust plan that a will just simply doesn't offer.
Right, right.
And, you know, beyond that, you know, like I said, not all trusts are created equal. A revocable living trust is great for your non-qualified money. If you have a huge IRA or something of that nature, a 401k, a lot of people have a substantial amount of their wealth in their house and in their retirement plans. Well, that revocable living trust may not be the best beneficiary
mm-hmm.
for your IRA. There's actually a special IRA inheritance trust that specifically is drafted specifically for the IRA so that instead of your beneficiaries getting the money outright, it goes to them in trust. And they're able to pull that money out over their lifetime. So normally when people receive an inheritance, you know, are a beneficiary on an IRA, they pretty much pull their money out outright and pay a boatload of taxes.
Right.
Because that's, you know, a lump sum income to them in 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes that shoots them up into a higher tax bracket that they otherwise, you know, wouldn't be under. Whereas if instead, or even if they take it out over a 5-year period, they've still got substantial taxes to pay on that. With the IRA Inheritance Trust, you can actually ensure that they pull that money out over their lifetime so that basically a $200,000 IRA that you leave behind may actually provide $1 million worth of benefits to your children over their lifetime because the money stays in the IRA, growing tax deferred. And, you know, since they pulled out little by little, they're paying less taxes on it over their lifetime. And it can lead to substantial inheritance and benefit that people just don't even consider.
I'm really beginning to see how a keen legal eye can become very, very important no matter what your asset level is in some ways.
Most certainly. And, you know, again, that's sort of why I chose to focus my practice
mm-hmm.
on estate planning, long-term care planning. There are so many nuances and, you know, techniques that are very important that you know the details and
right.
that you stay on top of it. So I basically chose to operate my practice as a mile deep instead of a mile wide.
Gotcha.
We focus on what we do, and we hope we, you know, do a very good job for our clients.
Good stuff. You also talk about the kind of, I'm going to put words in your mouth, the personal touch you bring to working with clients and clients' families. Law can be very dry, and it can be very objective and very impersonal. I'm gathering that four pillars really works differently with the families. Can you talk a little bit about that and why it's so important, both to you as a provider of services, but also obviously to the family as well, or the client?
Sure. It's very important to me that we know our client and we know their family and we know their family situation because, you know, no client is the same. And so we need to personalize, you know, the way that we you know, put forth an estate plan for them and the recommendations that we make. The recommendations I make for one family may be completely different than the recommendations that I make for another, mm-hmm. simply because they may have different family dynamics. The wealth that they have may be situated differently. Again, some may have it all in a house. Some may have the large majority in retirement accounts. Some may have it sitting in the bank. So, yeah, the type of family dynamics, the type of assets that we're dealing with, and just the families or the clients' concerns in general, you know, are all different and need to be, you know, dealt with differently. Our clients, honestly, I love them all. They are my extended family and, you know, and my friends. And we want to make sure that we provide the best planning and care for them, regardless of whether they are young parents with minor children who are looking at, you know, guardians and contemplating those things, to people who have saved up their nest egg and are looking at retirement and how best to plan for their wealth preservation and legacy for their family, mm-hmm. On to, you know, our elderly and senior clients that are looking at or facing the need for long-term care and how best to go about planning for those needs and how to pay for them.
Every family is different, has its own dynamic, and it's something you have to learn in every single case.
Exactly. Yeah, we actually have all of our prospective clients fill out a pretty detailed questionnaire, but there's a reason for that.
Sure.
Because we want to make sure that we're talking about the right things for them each time that we meet.
You just mentioned long-term care needs. It's an increasingly familiar concept that wasn't really a part of the fabric of our lives just a decade or two ago. It was a part of the fabric, but people didn't really just talk about it. Now, because of the aging of the baby boom generation, it's become really more top of mind for a lot of people. Why is long-term care planning important?
It's really important because if you don't have a plan in place, it can devastate your life savings as well as your family. Essentially, most studies show that 1 in 2 people are going to need some type of long-term care in their future. The type, frequency, and percentage of the people who will need long-term care increases greatly for people over age 70. Mm-hmm. And actually, the Department of Health and Human Services estimates that 70% of all people over age 65 will need some type of long-term care.
I've heard that statistic.
So, I mean, basically, you know, you may want to turn a blind eye on it, but, you know, it really could impact you personally and then essentially affect your family as well. So it's important that you have some type of long-term care plan in place. You know, my recommendation is for younger people, if they're able to qualify, that they look at procuring some type of long-term care insurance. You know, basically, you have to meet, you have to be healthy, and you have to be able to pay for it. You know, it's not inexpensive, but if you are able to do that, I most certainly recommend that you include that in your planning. You know, as you look toward retirement, if not before that. If you're not able to purchase long-term care insurance because you're not healthy or it's too expensive for you, there are some hybrid products on the market. You can invest in an annuity or life insurance, and there's a rider that companies can put on those policies, which basically essentially allows you to put a lump sum, say $100,000, into life insurance. But if at some point in the future you need long-term care, you can actually tap into that life insurance and use it to supplement and pay for your long-term care. The reason that people like those types of products these days is because it's sort of a guaranteed benefit both ways.
Right.
If you don't need long-term care, it's still life insurance.
You still get the death benefit.
Yeah, for your beneficiaries.
But the death benefit reduces, as I understand it, if you decide to convert to using the asset for care.
Yes.
Right? Which makes sense, you know, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
But you have that option. And actually, as I understand it now, I'm hearing more and more about this. Any life insurance policy that's in force mm-hmm. can actually be converted right. if it's done the right way. In fact,
yeah.
I've done some investigation to that, and I've been talking to a firm out in California that specializes in that. And it's a unique opportunity that I think few people know about.
Right.
And I've been doing some talks at various to various support groups and so forth mm-hmm. around town, making sure people are aware of that. Because I think I'm not involved in the company at all, but I think it's a fabulous, fabulous opportunity that too few people know about.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm the same way. I mean, you know, I don't. My practice is solely legal based. Mm-hmm, we don't sell any products, but you know that's part of the counseling that, that I try to provide to clients is the options that they may not be aware of that they might want to consider, you know, and looking toward their future. With that said, you know, when it comes to long term care planning, some people don't want to do either of those options, or it could be that you know they still need to be healthy for to qualify to invest in either of those products. So if they're not sufficiently healthy, then their other option is to look at legal planning, perhaps setting up a different type of trust, not the revocable trust that I've talked about earlier, but essentially an irrevocable trust. And again, not all irrevocable trusts are created equal. They are absolutely different depending upon the client's needs, the client's family situation, as well as the type of benefits that we may be looking toward down the line for eligibility. But you know, basically, if they're not able to invest in long-term care insurance or some hybrid policy, then an alternative is to look at doing some advanced legal planning, basically to protect some or all of their assets mm-hmm. in the face of the need for long-term care. The earlier that you do that, that you start thinking about those things and implementing the planning, the more options and opportunities that you'll have available to yourself. So it is important that, again, you know, you don't wait until you need the planning up front, mm-hmm. But that you do consider these things earlier in life.
I've learned enough doing this show that because I talk to a lot of people who are involved with support for seniors and for people as they age. I get really, really serious about it. I now have children in their 20s, and I want to make sure they know stuff earlier than I learned mm-hmm. about how to take care of myself as I get older. I didn't want to have you leave the studio today without spending at least a couple minutes talking about veterans. Mm-hmm. The VA is a huge agency with a huge responsibility to the men and women who have defended our country. Four Pillars, as I understand it, works with veterans a lot. Can you speak about some of the benefits available to veterans, some of which are not all that familiar, even to the veterans who need them?
Sure. I mean, a substantial part of my client base, you know, includes veterans, not only because they may be older in life looking toward needing long-term care and how to fund that, but, you know, basically the whole gamut. I mean, I've worked with veterans doing estate planning, the whole nine yards. But the one pillar of my practice, the Veterans Improved Pension Aid and Attendance Benefit, is spectacular for veterans who are over age 65 and are suffering from health issues and, you know, are looking for ways to help fund the care that they need. Essentially, the aid and attendance benefit, if a veteran served at least 90 days, one of which had to have been during wartime, and there are other than dishonorably discharged, if they are now, you know, having health issues and they need assistance with the core activities of daily living, like bathing and dressing mm-hmm. and that type of thing, and so they are, you know, hoping to stay in the home and they're paying for at-home care to come in and assist them, or if they've got family members that are coming in to help them, that they may want to pay for the time that they're spending doing that. The VA has this benefit that can pay out up to $1,100 for a surviving spouse or over $2,000 to a veteran with a spouse.
So the spouse can take advantage of this benefit as well.
Exactly.
That's fabulous.
Yeah. The spouse's benefit really kicks in once the veteran has passed away. Mm-hmm. During lifetime, they're going to look at the veteran first. But when the veteran's passed away, the surviving spouse, there's still a benefit for that person if they have those health issues and are looking at long-term care as well.
And for the veteran, a couple thousand dollars a month and even for the spouse, $1,100 can buy a significant amount of care.
It certainly can.
Right.
I mean, you know, national averages are, you know, basically $18-$20 for companionship care in the home. You know, if you're looking at moving into an assisted living facility, it's $3,500 on up. So, you know, any additional amount of money that, you know, might come in to help supplement your cost of care
Absolutely.
Could really make a big difference between, you know, basically providing you with quality of life for your entire life, because your savings will obviously, you know, last longer
with
additional income coming in.
I want to make sure our listeners remember that. That term is aid in attendance.
Correct.
Great.
Yeah.
Kelly Shovlin, Four Pillars Law Firm. How do we get a hold of you? Contact information.
You can get a hold of us at 910-762-1577. That's our phone number. And our email is fourpillars, that's FourPillars, at fourpillarslawfirm, again, spelled out, .com.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Kelly. Good to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.